Welcome to the Victims and Villains Podcast. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. I am Nostalgia, and on today's episode, we are talking about the Netflix miniseries When They See Us, and we are unpacking this powerful new series from Ava DuVernay. I'm hoping I pronounced that right, but I can't do it alone, so please help me in welcoming our guest for this episode, Mr. Coles Davis.
Hey, what's up, everybody? How y'all doing out there?
Well, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon. Well, from where I'm at, from up there, it might be nighttime. So
the sun is slowly setting on our day right now. But it's cool, man.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I don't really miss it being over there Eastern time. You know, Western time is such a difference, you know.
I always enjoyed when I got the chance to be West Coast and just to be like waking up at like 9 a.m. when it's like lunchtime everywhere else. And I don't know, you are totally right. Like, there's just something about that being on that specific coast time when everyone else is on that Eastern time, like it's a lot better.
Mm-hmm. It works best for like sports games, you know, like basketball. You know, the games used to start at like 10 o'clock, 10:30 when I would watch them on the East Coast, but now they come on at like 7 o'clock, 7:30. So that's very viable for me.
Nice. All right, man. Well, so we're here today talking about this Netflix series, and I was really on the fence about doing an episode on this particular series because I really like Ava DuVernay as a filmmaker, and I was recently really happy to kind of hear that she is doing New Gods with Warner Brothers in DC because I'm such a huge Jack Kirby fan, and now that they have Tom King, who did Mr. Miracle, attached to it, makes me even more excited. But just kind of seeing really what she's been able to do with properties like, or I guess properties is a proper term, just films and projects like When They See Us and Selma. Like, she's really poised to really bring a unique take to kind of those characters. But you were really the one that had really talked me, I think, into the idea of doing this episode. And I remember finishing up the series and just getting to that fourth episode and just being completely said, all right, I'm halfway through this final episode. There's no doubt in my mind anymore. This is an episode that needs to be done. And I kind of want to open up the conversation with, what is it about this series that you think makes it so important and so viable and crucial that people should watch it?
For me, this is one of the more not at before the series came to Netflix. I think this is one of the more infamous things that has been remembered. I know most of the African American community knows about the Central Park Five, but I think the general society didn't really know a lot about it, or they forgot about it. But yeah, for me, this series is just very important because we're seeing the same things that happened in this series still happen today. We're still seeing innocent African Americans being tried and convicted of crimes they may have not committed. We're seeing the criminal justice system still be a faulty system that has no signs of being fixed anytime soon. We're seeing mass incarceration. We're seeing racism. We're still seeing prejudice. We're still seeing all the things that Ava DuVernay greatly, greatly conveys and talks about in When They See Us. But also at the heart of this is a real American tragedy. We have five kids who were just in the throes of becoming like teenagers, like just boys, you know, like the age range was between 13 and 16. I can remember Corey Wise was the only one who was 16 that I remember. But these kids had their childhood taken away. You know, they had their aspirations, their goals, their prime taken away over a crime that they didn't do. And having to, I couldn't imagine like just what hit me the most is just I couldn't imagine like going through what these guys went through and still being able to live after all that. You know, because prison is one thing, but coming out of prison and trying to restart life after that is another type of hell to go through. This story is very important because it's very important for us to know the bad things, the bad moments in history. You know, everybody likes to talk about the good times in history, you know, the moon landing or the, you know, Benjamin Franklin or us winning our independence from Britain or, you know, just like great accomplishments, which is nice and everything. But also it's very important to remember the bad times in history, the bad moments, because history repeats itself, as the quote says. And I'm tired of seeing, you know, people being railroaded by the justice system and getting their lives taken away. So stories like this are very important, and it's very important for people to see this and to understand, you know, what happens when the criminal justice system doesn't work, because it's becoming a predominant trend these days and still is.
Absolutely. And so with that, we're going to kind of dissect a little bit of the themes and kind of get into review this a little bit. I think it's really important to start with the question of who are the Central Five as individuals. And I'm just literally just reading this from Wikipedia, but it kind of became this case of infamy in the late 80s. Basically, you have this woman named Trisha Miley, who was a white woman who was jogging in Central Park, and she was attacked by 8 others in the North Woods of Manhattan, Central Park, on April 19th, 1989. She was assaulted and raped, and this attack led to her basically being in this coma for 12 days. And Miley says here that she was a 28-year-old investment banker, and the New York Times called this one of the most widely publicized crimes of the 1980s. And so basically you had these kids that were just in the park. And you kind of even see this in the series where they have these 5 kids. You have 4 African Americans, and then you have a Hispanic, like you had said, like you have, they are 13 to 16 years of age, and they're basically sitting alone without parental supervision. And the detectives on the case are basically coercing this narrative to try and fit it as best that they can. And you know, you kind of see this dramatized in the series, where you have you have all these 5 kids who have never even met each other, save for Corey Wise and, oh man, I can't remember the other kid's name.
So you said Corey Wise, there's Kevin Richardson,
yeah,
Antron McRae, Yusuf Salam, and Raymond, I'm trying to see what his last name is.
Raymond Santana Jr.
Yeah, Raymond Santana Jr., yeah.
So, like, these kids have, like, never met each other except for Yusuf and Corey were the only two that had really, they were really friends. And so they basically just happened to be in the park when the cops had basically rolled up, and you get to kind of even see this in the series. They're just like questioning, like, you know, who is this guy? Who is this guy? Who is this guy? Because the narratives that they're shifting, they're trying to see who really was the one that had penetrated this woman. And the attacks in Central Park that night were allegedly committed by 30 teenagers, and police attempted to apprehend suspects, which we had just talked about. 4 African Americans and 1 Hispanic teenager were taken into custody. After lengthy interrogations, the 5 teenagers were tried variously on charges of assault, robbery, riot, rape, sexual assault, and attempted murder relating to the attack on Miley and others. Their prosecution was based primarily on confessions which they had made during police interrogations, which in some cases proceeded without parents or counsel or council president, which in and of itself I think was kind of one of the hardest things to watch. And you know, we just saw this a couple years ago when Netflix's other docuseries, Making a Murder, had kind of had a similar thing take place, and you get to get kind of, you get to see the raw footage of that. Here you have this 15-16 year old who basically gets just kind of goes through this whole entire interrogation process without a lawyer, without a parent or guardian present. And when you do that, the detectives that are leading the interrogation could really take that narrative and shape it in any way that they see fit. And to them, it basically looks like a confession.
Yeah, the interrogation scenes were on one side, they were greatly filmed. Like, you can see the intensity and see, like, you know, just the desperation of the kids. You could see the brutality of the cops and the way that they were forcing these kids and taking advantage of their innocence and naivety to make them lie on each other. But the thing I thought the whole time, I don't know if you thought this, but this was like a horror film. It was a horror film. It was scary to watch. Just watching these kids just like being hit, like being deprived of any food or water, not being able to use the bathroom, just being kept awake, sleep deprived, handcuffed to the chair. It was terrifying, to say the least. I couldn't imagine that the same thing probably wouldn't have happened to me if I was in a situation. If I was in a situation, I probably would have did the same thing. I probably would have started lying on the other kids, because, hey, if you say what they want you to say, you get to go home. And at the end, when you see that they don't get to go home, it's even worse. It pokes a hole in your stomach. You know, it's even worse. But yeah, the interrogation scenes were a tough watch. One of the toughest scenes to watch of the whole series.
Yeah, and I would specifically try and say, because there's that scene where Yusuf and Corey are coming out of the barbershop, and they see the cop, and the cop's like, hey, you know, come on, let's, you know, give me some ID. And so, you know, they give him, and Corey, like, had nothing to do with it. Like, he was basically just like, you know, hey, you know, you want to go down to the station? He was just being a good friend, and he ended up waiting there, and he ends up getting beat to a pulp to be the, quote, missing link between all of their narratives to weave this together. And that was honestly one of the toughest scenes in all to watch. And a lot of the narrative with the Corey Wise character, you just look at him, and I mean, props to the actor who brought this thing to life, because I mean, this character, this actor, like, he just kind of really goes through some of the, and I'm looking him up, because Jarnal Jerome.
Yeah, I think it's Jarheel Jerome. It's tough to pronounce his first name. I just call him Jerome to be on the safe side. But yes, he played in Moonlight a couple years back. He was in Moonlight, so he had been on my radar for a little bit.
Yeah, and it is one of the toughest things. But he I think in and of this self just kind of really makes this series worth the watch, because you get to really see that he just wanted to be this good guy, and he ultimately ends up really basically getting screwed in the end, for lack of a better word. And so kind of coming back to this they each later withdrew all these confessions, pleaded not guilty, and refused plea deals. DNA from semen samples found on and close to the victim did not match any of the accused, a fact which became known during the first trial. And even when you kind of go throughout that in the second episode, it is one of those things. It's like, have we really reached this point where if, like, literal DNA can't place you to the crime, then is that person, like, in any of the shape or doubt, even can you truly say that this person is guilty?
Yeah, Yeah, because like you said, in episode two, that's where we mostly get to see the internal mechanics of the trial, and you get to see the prosecution and defense, and you get to see the prosecution and the defense, and you get to see, you know, the boys and their lawyers, and they're trying to figure out how can we win this case, but it seems like the odds were already stacked against them already. I mean, they got the court, they got the trial set in front of a judge who had like a high convention rate, from what I heard from the from one scene in the film, and like the prosecution were not going to lose this case. They were doing whatever they could to not lose this case. They even wanted to put the boys all together, so the whole gang wolf pack narrative could stick, and that would make their guilt seem even more fruitful. But they were able to divide up the trial. Some of the boys, I think three of the boys had one trial to themselves. Two of the other boys had their trial together as well. So they were able to split them up, but it wasn't to where it was each individual, which would have gave them a better chance of defeating all the charges. So, yeah, I mean, this is pretty much a no-win situation for these guys. I mean, no evidence. All they had were the flimsy core statements and the videotape confessions. That's all they had. And it may be questioned, like, how would a jury of the peers see all this and still say guilty for all these kids? I didn't understand it.
Yeah, I don't either. And I think it's one of those most baffling things is, you know, they have these video confessions, but you just see the kids. And it's like, well, these are 13 to 16 year old kids. Like, kids are notorious. Like, it's almost in our DNA that when we are that age, like, we are still understanding the mechanics of right and wrong. So if you tell us that something is right, we are gonna say that. Like, that is just the mechanics. Like, I, as a teenager, I don't know how many times I lied, and looking back now as an adult, like, I try and tell the truth in the most painful of situations, and there have been times where the truth has caused a lot of division at my place of employment, in my marriage, between friends, and, you know, but I think also, too, it kind of goes back to this whole thing where we were talking about in the beginning, throughout the interrogations, like, should not evidence with a, quote, minor confession be, like, dishonorated if we are going to present them without a parent or guardian or counsel in that video?
Yeah, could we see in episode one, all these kids, you even see the police officer asking their parents or them, like, hey, can you take a break? And they get them out of the room. And for these cops, it was open season. This was a chance for them to go ahead and make the confession stick. Because look at it, if a kid has a parent there, has their parent there, they're going to feel comfortable sticking with whatever they said, because they know they got the safety, they got the protection, they know if their mom or dad is right there, hey, like, everything's going to be all right, like, these cops can do whatever they want to me, but my mom and dad are not going to let anything happen. So that made the scene between Antron and his dad even more, like, just sad, because you can see Antron and his mom, they were like, hey, my boy doesn't do that. He doesn't even talk to girls, you know? But then they take Antron's dad outside, and then they bring up that he was in prison in the past. And they want to use that to blackmail him at his current job. So they're essentially scaring him. They're telling him, hey, either your son complies, or we're going to go to your job and you're going to get fired. And so the dad has no choice but to go in to be like, hey, son, just say what they want you to say and then we'll be up out of here. But even that's a false promise. So, you know, it's just like the Yusef's mother in the series. He's like, you had these boys in here for hours, like, talking to them with unaccompanied by a guardian or a lawyer. Shame on you. And it's very shameful, very shameful.
Yeah, and so I to me, like, I think that, you know, if I was on a jury, like, and I was here for a case like this, like, to me, like, evidence like that, it shouldn't even register, because for all I know, there is a story behind why I'm seeing a 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old person, individual, confess to a crime like this, especially when a individual is going through, like, I'm not saying this, but I am saying from personal experience, when I was 16 or when I was 13 to 16 years old, like, I was still understanding the, I was still exploring the functionality of my sexuality. So I'm not gonna, you know, even consider rape. And you know, I was told from a very early age about sexual assault because I am, both my parents have been sexually assaulted. So it makes it that much harder to just, like you had said originally, like, to really understand the gravity of what is happening with these five individuals, and the horror to know that, you know, they went through this. And it, to me, it's really easy. We live in a binge. I was talking with one of my coworkers about this series, and to me, you know, we live in a binge culture. We just live in a culture now where it's easy to binge. Netflix drops seasons fully at a time, and it's like, okay, the new Daredevil season's out, or the new Punisher series out, or the new Stranger Things, and there goes my weekend. Like that's just the kind of. But this is a series that is so heavy to unpack, and so heavy to really get to see, and to the fact that what you're seeing actually took place makes it that much heavier and that much harder to swallow, and that much heavier to endure from start to finish.
Yeah, you make a really good point about, you know, our culture today about binge watching. Yes, you know, I have been guilty of that. You know, with the new season of Stranger Things, you know, and you know, when Luke Cage, The Punisher, when those shows came on, yeah, I was like, yep, this is my weekend right here. You know, I'm gonna sit back and just watch up all these episodes. So, but yeah, but seeing a series like this and knowing that this is actually our history, even if it wasn't our history, just seeing a situation like this and like watching it all together, it's so tough to watch. It's so tough to get through. I can't name the amount of moments that I cried during the series. And you know, for us, you know, as being as men, you know, sometimes it can be hard for most men to admit that they're emotionally mostly invested in something, or that they cried about something. But I'm not gonna lie, man, yeah, I cried so many moments during this series, especially during the Corey Wise episode. I think that was the most I probably cried. It's unbearable, man. It's unbearable. Like, my girlfriend's right there, and she could just see it, that I'm just like, I'm torn apart, you know?
Absolutely. And like, this, like, series like this, like, and Spotlight's another great example. Spotlight's a film that I continuously tell people, this is a movie that you need to see because of what happened and the story that inspired this. And it just kind of comes to really the, I kind of want to, I guess, address this, you know, when it comes to things like, Spotlight is a great example with that. I don't know if you've seen that one, with Michael Keaton and Mark Ruffalo, but it tells the story of the Catholic Church's kind of cover up for decades of all these priests that had basically, you know, willingly knew about all of these priests that were covering up, that were sexually assaulting these boys, but also like, and then covering it up, and then just shifting the parishes around so that they wouldn't do it. And it's a heavy movie, man. It's something that I really recommend. It's a very well done series, very well done film, shot beautifully, acted terrifically. But you know, when you have a something like that happened in the 70s, throughout the early this millennium, and then you have something like the Central Park Five, do you think that when you're addressing issues of like sexual assault or abuse or rape, do you think that we as a culture, like, the reason that that events like this kind of take place, and we just kind of want these narratives to make sense in our own minds rather than the truth, do you think that that kind of instills that we haven't reached that level as a culture yet where we just don't want to address these things?
I think people have a hard time of accepting that we live in a world that has boogeymen in it. You know, we it's because, you know, we when you watch a lot of TV, you know, depending on what you watch, you'll see this version of a manufactured version of what the world is. You know, you'll see a lot of positivity, which there is a lot of positivity. Don't get me wrong. The world can be a good place if you know how to look for it. But
absolutely.
But you also have to acknowledge that there is a dark side to to our country and the world itself. And I think people have a hard time of, like, you know, when they see stories like this of, like, you know, kids being sexually assaulted, or like people, you know, men and women being raped, or, you know, when you see like people getting killed or people being robbed and assaulted, that scares people. You know, people thrive off of fear. Not thrive off of fear, but they let fear control them. So if I don't want to let fear control me, then I'm just going to continue to live in a world of delusion, to where I just see things just in this viewpoint, but not in the other viewpoint. So I think that's why we have a hard time of coming to terms when we see stories like this. Like, you'll constantly see stories of these priests, you know, who are sexually assaulting kids, and then you'll see people come out and be like, well, that can't be possible, like they're doing the good work of the Lord, like that, like these kids are just making it up, they don't know what they're talking about, they don't know what sex is. Like, but how can you fathom even like discrediting what kids are talking about? The one thing I've always noticed about kids is that they will tell you the truth when it comes down to it. Whenever a kid comes to you and be like, hey, like, mommy, something like this happened, they're going to tell you the truth about it. If a kid tells you that, hey, like, hey, you're being mean to me, you're probably being mean to that kid. You know, if a kid tells you that, hey, you know, you look kind of ugly, you probably do look kind of ugly. You know, I've noticed kids can be the most honest people that we know. So, you know, when we see, like, people just like discrediting these events or not wanting these events to be true, or just like hiding away from them, it just shows me that they want to live in a world of delusion and not accept reality. And a lot of people can't accept reality. They live in reality, but they can't accept it.
That's a good point. And like, not to really contradict myself from earlier with, you know, not always believing kids, I think that by the time we reach 13 to the ages of these boys, I think we've kind of grown to know what right or wrong is, but also to want to, I'm getting like, but we know when to tell the truth. And I think that is the core belief of what I'm going to say next is, I think, you know, our kids pastor at my wife and I's church just spoke this past weekend, and she had talked about, you know, what she loves most about doing. She's our children's pastor, and she had spoken. She was like, she was asked by someone, she was like, well, what do you like about working with kids so much? And her answer was, they have no filter. Like, they will just tell you how it is. Like, if your breath stinks, your breath stinks. You know, if you're like, if your music sucks, it sucks. If the movie's good, it's good. If, you know, and if your meatloaf is good, it's out of this world. like, kids just kind of tell it how it is. And by the time, you know, you reach the age of these boys, I think, in certain, you know, given these circumstances, you're not gonna lie. Like, what value are these kids gonna have in not lying? Like, to them, they are telling these lies so that they can go home, because they have been without parents, without sleep, without food, without bathroom breaks for almost pushing 2 days straight. And that's the thing. I think that, you know, sometimes in seasons of depression or in just the harder times of life, if you're surrounded by those negative influences for so long, there's a little part of you that kind of slowly starts to believe those things. I definitely know that when I went through my depression in my teenage years, for me, being around negative influences definitely took a residence up in the who I was as an individual. Like, those negative influences started to alter my identity. And you know, teenagers are susceptible, and if cops are going to tell you, hey, you're going home, you're going to believe, hey, you're going home.
Well, see, you have to think about that added dynamic, you know, of these, the color of these kids, you know, because these kids are, they're black, you know, they're black and brown kids, you know. So they've already heard stories probably from their parents or seen in their neighborhood what the cops will do to you, you know. Like, if they want to get something from you, you know, it's like Antron Dass. He said, you know, these cops, they'll do anything. If they want something, they will do it. They will lie about us. They will hurt us. They will kill us. You know, so we got to be on guard for that. So these kids, you know, them being black and brown, they already know they're behind the eight ball, you know, as far as everything. So, and they're afraid of these cops. You can see it in these kids' faces. They're afraid of these cops. They don't know these cops because these cops are hitting them. They're beating them. Who knows? These cops could probably end up killing them. So they're operating on that fear. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to get up out of there. You've ever been in a place where it just felt so uncomfortable that you just had to get up out of there?
Absolutely.
So you have to imagine these kids have been through 20 hours of hell. They've been through hell, and you're trying to do whatever you can to get up out of there. You want to be in the loving grace of your mother's arms. You want to, like, be in your bed again. You want to be able to go back to doing what you were doing before you got caught up in this mess. So these kids are willing to confess to anything in order to get out, but not knowing that they're playing right into the hands of the prosecution and the police officers who want them to do that. Like, they have this guy, I don't know if you noticed, but whenever the cops would start going crazy or start hitting them or start screaming at them, this guy would come in and he would send these guys out of the door. He'd be like, hey man, you know, like, these guys, like, they're bad, man, but, you know, I'm the good one and I'm trying to get you up out of here. Like, they had the good cop, bad cop routine going on. And I found him to be the most despicable out of all the cops. To be honest, the other cops, they're doing what they do. That's who they are. Like, I'd rather a person show me who they are than to hide who they are. But this guy was pretending to be a good cop and say, like, hey, man, like, if you confess to this, like, I'm trying to do whatever I can to get you home, okay? Just get you home. Like, it was so despicable. So shameful.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, to kind of talk also what you're saying with, you know, going back to the skin color of these kids, and not that it matters, but I think recently, too, you look at the opening sequence from The Hate U Give, and mm-hmm. just the father training his own children. You know, I think they were like 9 and under, about just how to handle what happens when cops pull you over, because it was, you know, he knew that it was going to happen at some point or another because of their skin. And walking out of, you know, The Hate U Give or When They See Us, and you just walk out, and to me, it puts a really bad taste in my mouth that, you know, we are having to, that there are families out there, fathers and mothers, that are having to train kids and tell kids these stories basically because of something that they can't control. Like, you can't control if you are born into a Native American family, or if you're born into a Japanese family or a Chinese family or a Caucasian or an African American. Like, that, those circumstances are out of your hands, and whatever you do, there's just stuff that I don't feel like personally that, you know, we should live in a culture. It makes me sad that we live in a culture that circumstances that are out of our hands are, that's how we approach individuals and people in certain situations.
Yeah, you brought up a really, really great point, because The Hate U Give, which is one of my favorite films from last year, yeah, that opening scene, it talked to me a lot, and I'll connect it over to When They See Us. Yeah, I've had those conversations, you know, as far as my grandparents sitting me down, or my uncles or my aunties, my mom and dad just giving me tips. Like, whenever I went outside of the house, or whenever I was hanging out with friends, they just told me, hey, be careful. You know, if you see something going on, get away from it. And if you ever have to get into contact with a cop, then do whatever they say. Be calm, be courteous as possible, and do not do anything that will cause you to, like, get a gun pointed at you or get arrested. And it's a sad fact of life that, you know, you have kids born into situations, like you said, of being the color of their skin being judged, and from day one that labeling is right on them, you know. And I still feel it to this day. There's sometimes for me, I like to go out a lot, but not go out to clubs, so just like go out to the movies and stuff. But every time I go out to movies, I do have that air of fear around me that, like, hey, is this the night that a cop pulls me over for something? Like, I need to make sure that I'm doing everything right. I need to make sure I do not, like, that I'm in the right situation, I'm in the right place, I have to watch my surroundings. It's a common fear that a lot of African Americans share, you know. And it's nice to see that, you know, somebody like you acknowledges that, you know, because a lot of people will say, like, oh, well, you just, like, you don't, like, that's not a real fear and stuff. Like, you're just going off what the media says. It's like, no, I lived through experience like this. My friends have lived through experiences like this. My family has. And, you know, from when they see us, I think that title speaks for itself. When they see us, like, when they see people like us, you know, we have all these stereotypes, all of this judgment, all of these preconceived notions that we have to fight against every day of our life. No matter how much successful we become or good things we do, or even just like staying out of trouble, we still have those stereotypes and preconceived notions that we're always going to have to fight. And sadly, these boys fell victim to all those preconceived notions, and they end up losing most of their prime years of life.
Yeah, and I feel like that's one of the hardest things to endure about the situation, or to know, A, that it really happened, but B, you also see the Corey Wise scene, I think, because they went so much more in depth with his character arc in the series, and you just kind of look at just what he went through, and just knowing that he almost kind of feels responsible for it in some way, shape, or form. And you see how this event really takes its toll on him, because he left his girlfriend to go to the park, and mm-hmm. ultimately he kind of was just kind of caught in wrong place, wrong time, but it ultimately eats away at him. And you just kind of see this arc throughout him about how much he's isolated, because how much he's terrified for that, mm-hmm. for specifically for his, you know, well-being, because everyone believes that he did what they say he did. And there's also another arc in this one with the Corey Wise, and you also kind of see it with, I'm trying to think which one specifically, like Raymond was another great one of his arc, where, you know, he gets out of prison and he's trying to find a job, and you don't really think about it, but these kids are now that they're out of prison, they're also having to label themselves and register as sex offenders, which is really damaging and damaging their life even further to kind of experience this road to redemption.
Yeah, I think the great thing about this series is that not only does it show the whole Central Park case down to the accurate detail, but it also humanizes these characters. Like, as kids, you see them, they're dressing, you see in the opening scenes, like, they're just going out and just having fun with their friends. You see Kevin, he wants to be a trumpet player. You see Antron, him and his dad love talking about baseball. You see Raymond, you know, he's walking with his friends talking about, hey, I gotta look good for the girls and everything. And then you see Corey, he's hanging out with his girlfriend and everything. They're just sitting there eating and everything. Then, you see the thing, of course, it ends to him, like, you know, ended up, like, going through hell and everything. But you see his boys coming to the window, and then his girl's like, I know you're not leaving me and stuff like that, you know. Those little moments in, I'm trying to think of the, and then you see Yusuf, he just going out just to hang out. So you see these kids and everything, and then they go to prison, they get out, and now they're full-grown adults now, you know. And they're going back out into the world that hates them. You know, they always talk about, like they say, like, these people, they hate me, you know, they think I did this, and they're calling me a monster, and they're calling me animals, they're calling me a savage, and that I should be dead, you know, like, I should have been killed in the electric chair, you know, for what I did, for what they're saying I did. And you see, in one scene, Raymond is going, he's talking with his, I think it's his parole officer, and they go, he says, like, hey, like, you need to check in here, like, every 90 days for the rest of your life, and you're like, mm-hmm. you need to apply for a job. And like Raymond's like, okay, so what do I do? He's like, okay, well, this box right here, you got to check right here that you're a felon, you got to check right here that you're a sex offender. Like, if you're a felon, you can't like be around anybody else who's a felon, because you know what, you get sent to prison. You know, if you're a sex offender, you can't be near kids or anything, you can't be near school, or you gotta live in a certain radius away, or you know what, you're going to prison. And if you don't get a job, even though we're making it hard for you to get a job, because for one, felons don't really get a fair shot at getting a job, because most of these companies see them as troublemakers instead of seeing them as redemptive stories. They could be great redemptive stories. Like, mm-hmm. hey, you could be a CEO and you can like grab a guy who was in jail and be like, hey, you know what? This guy was in jail. He made a mistake, but you know what? I'm gonna give him a shot and prove to me that he can be an upstanding member of society. No one does that. So Raymond asks the guy, so what am I supposed to do with all these limitations? Like, what if a job calls me? Because he has a curfew to where he has to be in the house by 9 o'clock p.m. He can't be on the sidewalk. He can't be on the stoop. He has to be inside the house. So he said, like, hey, like, what if I get a job and the job wants me to come in early? And then the guy's like, well, get another job. And I was like, get another job? He's even lucky if he gets a job. You know, that's the mind-blowing thing about it. The criminal justice system, once you're out of prison, you're not really free. You're just in control by the state. You know, you can't really hardly travel anywhere. You can't get a license to do anything. You got to register as this and that. You got to have that stigma. And they just make it harder for you to have any quality of life to where you can support yourself. And that's why we have high levels of recidivism, where people, they get out of prison, they end up going back because they don't have any opportunity to make a living.
Yeah, and I mean, it is a sad factor that, you know, it's, I am going to have to edit all this out. Give me one sec.
Okay.
All right. But it kind of reminds me, I often like to articulate thoughts through like quotations in like pop culture, and there's a rapper by the name of Andy Mineo, and he has this song called Wild Things, and he talks about, you know, showing these stereotyped black or African-American gentlemen, you know, what a family is supposed to look like instead of these broken homes. And, you know, I think that we create this cycle of this like prison system being a revolving doors, because we're not really, we not only do we set these limitations, but we don't kind of teach these people how to really bring redemption to themselves, because it almost kind of seems like once they have been in the system for a long period or a certain period of time, or they might be of a certain race, or they might have done a certain crime, that we just kind of write them off as saying, you are forever this person. If that was the case, then I would be forever a depressive, self-loathing, hated person. But I have turn my life around, and you know, I've overcome addiction and violence and just depression and anxiety, and I've done all of these things, you know, because of religious reasons. But you know, it's redemption story is a redemption story no matter where the redemption comes from. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I think that, you know, I love at the end where they're showing all of where how this case has affected them, and you get to Corey Wise, and Corey Wise now has a foundation where he takes cases like his own, and he says, look, you know, we're going to bring redemption to your name. Like, if there is actual evidence saying that, you know, you are innocent, we're going to show this innocence, and we are going to find your redemption. And but you also look at him throughout the duration of the series, and just knowing how, no matter how hard the life got, you know, no matter how many times he went to go face before the parole, he would not break. You see that great sequence. You see that great sequence with Chris Chalk's aunt, or Yusuf character, as an adult, and you know, during the meeting in the church, you know, where they were trying to, you know, talk about how they were quote sex offenders, and they're like, no, look, we were wrongfully accused and wrongfully imprisoned for this crime, and we have been stating our innocence for years, and we're not going to start changing our tune now, like, you know. And then she's like, well, you got to go find another group, and he's like, fine. You know, which is I think we'll talk about it here in the review section. But Chris Chalk in this, for the very little time that he is in this, he was also in Detroit, and he just got done playing Lucius Fox in Gotham. Mm. I cannot wait to see what this guy does, because everything that he has just been in, he has just turned in such a powerful performance, and he's one of the I think more underrated actors that's working today. But kind of to bring it back to, you know, just it could be a redemption story, and I think we look at someone's past and where they've been and say, we never look at someone and say, this is where you can be. We just kind of write them off saying, okay, because of you know, because of your gender, because of your beliefs, because of your sexual identity or orientation or race, and the fact that you've spent at 3 to 3+ or 5, 15, whatever, how many years in prison, we can't hire you, or, you know, we discriminate because of things. You know, we talk about how far we've progressed, and in some ways we have, but there's always going to be that backbone that is the opposition of that progression.
Yeah, you know, it's nice to see that all of these guys, you know, putting, you know, this thing is going to follow them forever for the rest of their lives, but it's great to see that these guys are doing stuff in the community. They're making a name for themselves. They're able to find ways to be able to make a living, and they're also giving back. You know, they're trying to make sure that, hey, we're not going to let anybody else go through what we went through. And, you know, you talked about Corey having his foundation. I know some of the other guys do criminal justice stuff as well, to be able to support the exoneration and claim of the innocence of people who have been wrongly tried. And I also see that Raymond, he has his own clothing company on Park Avenue. Yeah, Park Avenue, that he founded. So that's also good to see. But I think this show at the end shows a true testament to all these guys. You know, they are really true survivors in every sense of the word. Not many people could go through what they went through and still be able to live after that. And it was a great shot for Ava at the end of the whole series to actually show the guys who they really were, like show the people who played them and then show their real faces. That was a beautiful moment. Very beautiful.
Absolutely. I think that was actually one of my favorite moments. Biopics are one of my favorite, or like, you know, the tellings of real life. Like there are some of my favorite stories to see brought to life cinematically or through other dramatized formats, and getting to kind of see this journey, especially after you get through that heart-wrenching episode with Corey, and when you kind of see that, you know, this DNA has proven them, and, you know, they basically... It was in the 1990 they were convicted in 1990, and they received sentences that spanned 5 to 15 years. They served actually 6 to 13 years in prison, and it was in 2001's Martina Reyes, a convicted murderer and serial rapist who was in prison, confessed to actually raping the jogger. His DNA is DNA match samples found on and near the rape victim, and there was other confirmatory evidence. So he was convicted of the rape alone. At the time of his confession, Reyes was already serving life sentences for other crimes, and he was not prosecuted for raping. The lady Trisha Mealy, mm-hmm. is how I'm going to say her name, because of the state limitations had passed by the time that he had confessed. So in 2002, Robert Morgan, through the district attorney for New York County, recommended that the convictions of the five men related to the charge and the assault and rape of Mealy and the attacks on others be evacuated. In the legal position, the parties are treated as though no trial has taken place. The convictions were vaccinated in 2002. So these guys spent 12 years with this over their heads, not to mention the probably almost full year of 1989 with the whole prosecution and journey and the trial, because it was in 1990 that the actual sentencing took place. So these guys spent almost 15 years with this over their heads. And so that in and of itself, I think, is just really heavy. And then you see how they held on to hope throughout this time. And like you said, like, these guys are, first and foremost, these guys are just thoroughly survivors. And it is just it's awesome to know that redemption is possible as long as you keep holding on. And it is some of the hardest things to hold on to during the toughest seasons of our lives. And you know, you talked about, you know, every time you go out, always having that fear, is tonight going to be the night that I pull over and or get pulled over because of my race or because of the color of my skin? And you know, having to kind of go through that. And you know, how is it for you, I guess, to kind of see a story like this unfold and play from start to finish, and just kind of seeing that this experience, how they have been able to really use this experience to really, really basically free others so that they don't have to go through this process?
It shows on redemption at its finest. It shows that no matter what or how society or other forces tried to break down these men and didn't break them down, they went through it all and they made good of going through it all. As far as they're not going to be able, no matter what they do, they're not going to be able to get the years that they lost back. That will never happen, you know. But now they can be able to make best use of the years that they do have left. And also, for me, now I'm starting to see, but what I thought that should have happened earlier is that we're starting to see the backlash and the outcry for the people responsible for putting these kids in jail. We're starting to see they are starting to get their comeuppance, even though this should have happened many, many years ago. Linda Fairstein is now, she's resigned from a lot of these charities, from her position in some club. And, you know, she erased off her social media because of the outcry from this show. And she's been on record still stating that she doesn't believe that the boys are still innocent. She still believes that they are guilty, and that the guy who ended up confessing to Reyes, that he was just a sixth guy. And Elizabeth Lederer, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, but the lawyer, she is still teaching at Columbia University and everything like that, you know. But they and these cops, they need to get their comeuppance. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't like calling for any mob mentality or anything like that, but they can't just get away with this, you know. I mean, you know, railroading these kids and making them lose a part of their life, that should be a crime within itself. I'm surprised that most of these cops or anything didn't go to jail for the exoneration that did happen. And then, of course, you get the moment you see in episode 2 where Donald Trump, our current president at this moment, called for the death penalty for kids. I'll say that again. He took out full page ads in the New York Times and called out the death penalty. So he wanted these children essentially to die for a crime they didn't commit, and he's now the president of the United States. So in some respects, karma hasn't done full justice, but I can live with the solace that these guys are making good time of what they have left from this case. And it's an American redemption story at its finest. It doesn't get talked about a lot, but these guys are doing their part. And, you know, the show is tough to watch, but it's good to know that these guys are still out there surviving and doing what they can.
Yeah, and to kind of also touch on the Donald Trump, it says here that the advertisement was estimated to cost $85,000 to take out, and to just invest that much money into a thing, and it's not even a month after, this ad was taken out literally 2 weeks after all of these accusations of these kids came forth. And you know, I think we always, like the saying is you are always innocent until proven guilty, and the thing about that is I think that we like to say that when it's not us in the spotlight. Like if we believe someone has done it, they are automatically guilty. I don't care whatever the evidence says. If the evidence comes across them saying not guilty, it's them. You know, we both love movies, and I have some controversial movie picks, and Man of Steel, I think, was a good example of, you know, here you have this first real authentic Superman reinvention from the first time in almost 40 years, and everyone had, I felt like at the time, almost like went in expecting to hate it, and because they built themselves up for so long to hate it, they in some way, shape, or form actually ended up hating it. But the ones that went in with open minds, I feel like, you know, it wasn't necessarily as bad or as negative as we perceive it. So we've kind of almost trained ourselves that if we believe something is true, then it doesn't matter the evidence at hand, we're gonna believe and stick to what we believe. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're talking about, it's called it's associated with like confirmation bias, you know. I'll add on to what you're talking about. You know, if we do believe in something, we'll look for anything to support that. So, like, for instance, when you went to the films to see Man of Steel, you know, and you thought that was pretty good, but the people who just wanted to go ahead and hate it already hated it, they probably were looking for bad reviews to just support their point, or just looking for comments and statements that supported that, hey, Man of Steel was trash, but, you know, and everything like that. But it's very hard, because it's very hard for people, when they get an idea in their head, they don't want to go against it because it makes them look bad. And I think as far as associating that with when they see us, you see the cops, the lawyers and the prosecution who were involved, either Donald Trump himself, when it came out that these guys were innocent, they still stuck to their guns and said, like, oh, well, I mean, no, I mean, they clearly did this. Like, Reyes was just a sick guy, or there's no way that they were innocent. I mean, they confessed to it. So people, at the end of the day, they're going to believe what they believe. And sadly, a lot of people do not like to admit fault. I think that's the biggest issue sometimes with people these days, is that if they're found out to be wrong, they'll do anything to fight against proving that they were wrong. They'll make up another story to try to support their findings, or they'll just like hightail and just run away and try to change the conversation. So, yeah, I mean, if you go in with an idea and you're supportive of that idea, you'll do anything to fight it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that it kind of goes back to that just being a culture of stigma. There are portions of it where, we're getting ready. My wife and I were getting ready to speak to a group of youth tomorrow. And like the last time that we spoke with it, like you have like those people that when you tell them that, you know, our podcast is suicide prevention, mental health, but it's also pop culture, you get those people that are very much like, okay, that's interesting. And then you get those people that are like really excited because it was something that they're passionate about. It's something that they've gone through. Like, they think that, you know, mental health shouldn't be a thing of stigma. And, you know, I think the reason that mental health has this giant stigma is because there's a small portion of us that we don't like to admit that we're wrong, or that we're flawed, or that we have, that we're not perfect. You know, you look at what we push on Facebook. I have friends on Facebook that will post both good and positive. I have, you know, that when they're mad, Facebook is a tool for them to vent, and in that way it's good. But then you also have people that use social media to post the really positive things, and there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, it just kind of feeds into that ideology that we don't like people to see the ugly side of who we are.
Yeah, man, you know, it's great to be positive, because I do believe in the law of attraction. You know, whatever you think about, you know, all that energy, whatever you put out there is going to come back to you in tenfold. So I do believe in that. But just because you know that there's bad stuff going on and you accept that, doesn't mean that, you know, your world has to be bad. I mean, you can still have a great look out in the world. You just have to accept that there's sometimes bad things are going to happen, and circumstances come up where, you know, you see the ugliness of things. But you just have to steadfastly still remain strongly believing in the beauty of things while still accepting the bad. But people just find it hard to really, like, to be able to deal with both sides of that.
Absolutely. And there are really, we live in a culture where it is really hard to talk about certain things. You know, we talk about, we specifically, this show deals very much with suicide prevention. The reason we create this content is so that people can know that there is hope, but it's also to educate people and say, hey, look, you're not alone. 129 people, they die every day by their own hand. For every suicide that is successful, 25 more are being attempted right here in our own backyard. That is 1.1 million suicides that are attempted each and every day. There are 800,000 that occur every year. That's one death every 40 seconds. But even past that, you know, this series opens up and this whole case opens wide because of sexual assault. There are, every 92 seconds, there is an American that is sexually assaulted. And we create this content so that we can break down stigmas and tell people that, hey, it's okay not to be okay. Like, we want to come, it doesn't matter what you believe, what fandom you belong to. We just want you to know that there is hope and that this is a safe place, and in hopes of seeing a change spark and come forth, that no matter how hard this life gets, that it's always worth holding on for. And when you look at a story like Corey Wise, or I specifically say that because the series just, I feel like, dealt really strongly with his arc so predominantly. But you look at this, a story like the Central Park Five for all these kids, and you see that, you know, they went through all of these negative things, but at the same time, they held on to hope, and they held on and said, we're going to be proven innocent. You watch. You wait. We don't know how. We have faith in it. And Yusuf's a great example, because, you know, it's the show featured really predominantly that when he was in prison, he converted and became a Muslim. And his whole faith in Muslim was a cornerstone to what helped him get through those rough times.
Yeah, you know, they talked about in the show, Kevin Richardson's sister was talking about that, hey, life is all about having something to look forward to. You know, it's very easy just to sit and wallow in grief and misery, but the mother was saying, nah, that's lazy energy. We got to live, you know, we have to look forward to something, you know, whatever that is, be just find something to look forward to. And that spoke to me a lot, because I will admit, at times I do deal with depression, I deal with stress, I deal with anxiety, you know, for the most part, but the thing that does help me and that helps me carry on is that I know I have support. I have love from people I care about. And also, I'm passionate about film and everything involving cinema. So that's what I have to look forward to, you know, and that's what gives me the strength and the energy to continue to keep going and to not let myself wallow into a pity party, you know. And going back to what you were saying about, you know, you raising awareness, you know, about society and mental health, that's, those two topics right there are very, very important, because we live in a social media age where people, you know, it's very easy to judge yourself based on other, how other people are living. You know, we go on Facebook, we go on Instagram, we see people with these pictures of hanging out at a party or just having fun or being on a vacation. And it's very easy to judge our current livelihood with their livelihood. And, you know, that can lead to a lot of just like feeling down about yourself and just feeling like you're worthless, or just feeling like, man, well, they're living a life and I'm not, you know, what I'm doing here, they're not feeling like appreciative, or they may not be grateful or thankful for what they're doing because of what they're seeing on a screen, you know. And so just harking back on that, I think it's just very important that in life, we have to have something that keeps us going, you know, whatever that chooses to be. Hey, for you, if it's like playing a video game, then have at it. If for you, if that's like playing a sport, have at it. For you, if it's like reading or writing something, have at it. You know, just, we got to have something that keeps us living.
Absolutely. And so I think we've talked a lot about this case as a whole. I think we've talked and spent a lot of time on just the themes that this show presents, but I kind of want to jump in just in the last few moments of this, of just kind of just the general thoughts that we have and why people should definitely check this out, because, you know, we're getting ready to get into this season as a, you know, like to draw back, like both of our first passions, I think, are definitely cinema and definitely going to the movies and experiencing it. And we're getting into that infamous summer blockbuster series. And so the blockbuster season is a weird season, because you have like all of these big budget films that are getting ready to come out. We just had Dark Phoenix. We're coming off of the high that was, you know, Avengers Endgame. Godzilla is a big deal right now. Aladdin's still a big deal. We're gearing up next month for, you know, Hobbs and Shaw. It's Lion King. Like, you know, Men in Black. Like, there's just so much of these big action blockbusters and just fun summer movies. But I think in the midst of all of that, sometimes projects like When They See Us, they kind of have this tendency to get lost in that somewhere. And I think that this is a series that is a must need. Like, this is a crucial series that everyone should watch at least once, because it does say a lot about how our courts handle cases. It does say a lot about how sometimes we, you know, our law enforcement can handle certain suspects or situations based on, you know, based on evidence or subjects that are outside of their control. And it's really heartbreaking, but at the same time, like, it really is honest in its betrayal, and it does not pull back its punches whatsoever. It is a heavy show, but it's something that I think, you know, just it should be experienced so that it can be conversated about, because I think that's one thing that I really, really admire about Ava DuVernay as a filmmaker, is that she's not just and Ava DuVernay and Jordan Peele's another one, that they're not just making movies just to make them. Spike Lee's another one. They're just all popping into my head, but they're making these movies as a way to use the medium of film to start conversation and in the hopes of sparking civil change and social justice, the way that, you know, you look at the civil rights movement of the 60s and Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King. Like, they want to see stuff like that changed. And even last year with Doctor Who did the going back with the Rosa Parks, and you know, her companions, if you've ever seen that show, they're typically always white, and this time around they were a African-American gentleman and a female of Indian descent. And it was really, really powerful to kind of get to see, you know, what that specific genre of sci-fi had to say on issues like social change and racism and how far we've come. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think that this series is a great series to be seen simply for the fact that it needs to have conversations. We need to have conversations about this, because conversations, that is where the spark of change happens.
Yeah, for me, it's very great to see filmmakers when they use their skills and their talent and their productions in order to enact change or to spark conversation. There's nothing more fun to me in the world than sitting down with someone and having a conversation about a film or a TV show. It's one of the best feelings ever, you know, because you...
Absolutely.
Yeah, you get to hear differing opinions. You get to, like, maybe agree on a couple of things. And, you know, you just get to have... You get to have a discussion about something that people can interpret in so many ways. So, you know, what Ava DuVernay did is that she re-sparked the issue. She re-sparked the interest in this case. And she also re-sparked us to also look out for more cases like this, you know, to make sure that we don't let something like this happen again. For me, as far as a series, I would say that this is probably one of the best pieces of film and TV I have seen this decade. I wouldn't be surprised if it landed into my top 10 for the whole decade at the end of this year. The acting is beautiful. The acting is just amazing. Like, everybody brings it, you know, including the cops, the prosecution. You know, everybody in this series is putting on a great performance. Felicity Huffman as Linda Fairenstein, I hated her character, but she played it so well. That was the reason why I hated it so well. So, you know, she did her job. The little kid who played Kevin Richardson, he did amazing. Michael Kenneth Williams, who played Antron's dad, he was great as well. I love to see him in more stuff. He's one of my favorite, like, little character actors. He doesn't get a lot of roles, but whenever I see him in a movie, I'm very excited to see him, because he played in The Wire. My favorite TV show of all time is Omar Little, character Omar Little. So he will always have a special place in my film fandom. Also, of course, we talked about Jerome. He probably, for me, has the best performance out of anything I've seen this year. You know, his episode was the toughest to get through, but he carried it all the way through. And, you know, he just... He got down the mannerisms of Corey Wise. He got down the speaking, you know, just his whole performance was just like he almost stepped into the shoes of Corey Wise and just was able to, like, play him for this whole time. It was amazing. I also love the direction that AV brought to this. The cinematography is excellent. Like, even the beginning episode where she sets the stage for the time period that we in. You know, we hear the music, we see the haircuts that these kids have, we see the clothing, we see the set design, we even see the casting. Like, every actor or actress looks exactly like their real life counterpart. It's amazing how they did that. It's like some kind of voodoo magic or something that she did. And you know, the pacing is great. There's not one boring minute in the series. It's all engaging. It's all interesting. Every minute of the series, like, there's always something to look at or be excited by. You know, I mean, Subject Matter is tough, but it's a very, very well-made series. Very, very good. I would put this on the same level as HBO's Chernobyl. I hope that's how you pronounce it. Chernobyl, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, and this series, you know, I didn't even really kind of dig into the acting aspect of it. But you, like you had said, like, Jerome does a fantastic job. He definitely steals the show, I think, for me. But this series has so many, like you talked about Michael K. Williams, just being these character actors that show up from, you know, and you named it a bunch. But John Leguizamo, I think, is one actor that I, as of the past couple of years, has just turned in some dynamitely,
yes,
phenomenal dramatic performances. And here you have a guy that got his start in stand-up and did a lot of, you know, comedies for a while, and then he turns out and does things like Waco and When They See Us, and you just say, this guy is vastly underappreciated. And he has one of the most emotionally tormented arcs throughout the course of this series, just to kind of, you know, get to see his brother or his son go through this, and then you kind of see where his life is evolved by the third episode. And Neasley Nash, I think, is another one who plays Corey's mom. She is I've been on the fence about watching Claws, which is her new her latest TV show. it looks so interesting to me, and like something that would be like right up my alley. But I think too is that she is just kind of this actress that just shows up in these like most random of things, and mostly comedic performances, and she just turns into some really gut-wrenching performances throughout the course of this, especially the scene in particular where Corey's brother comes out and says that, you know, he's transgender, and she basically rebukes him and rejects him from, you know, as an offspring. And it's just one of the most heart-wrenching things to do. And then there's also that scene where towards the middle of the fourth episode where she goes to visit Corey and she says, you know, hey, I found Jesus and I've been praying for you. And but it's just, you see this arc that she goes through, and she just turns in this like one of the best performances in the course of this. And then Framke Jansen of the X-Men movies is in this. Joshua Jackson from Dawson's Creek is another good one in this one. But I mean, there are just, then you have Werner Framke, who's Elizabeth Letter, however you say it. She's also in this from the Conjuring movies and Bates Motel. Like this, there is just no wasted performance in this. And it's such a tightly told story that from, like you said, like from start to finish, it's completely engaging. They set up the time period really well. I would compare the storytelling aspect of the first like 15-20 minutes and setting up just the year and the culture to the way that F. Gary Gray set up the Rodney King portion of Straight Outta Compton. I would, you know, just to really recreate that culture and just really recreate kind of what life was like back in the time during, you know, that as to be an African American in the Rodney King trial.
Great, you know, great production design throughout all of the eras of the film. I did find one continuity error in the fourth episode of the series, when Corey Wise is in the he's listening to music when he's mopping up the floor in I think he was in Attica during this term. Yeah, but then a DMX song comes on, and it's supposed to be set in the 90s, but that DMX song did not come out until 2001. I'm sorry to be a nerd like that, but yeah, that was one continuity error I found. But otherwise, everything else was in the right time period. And also, Jahiel Jerome, at first, when I first saw his transformation to the older Corey Wise, I thought it was a new actor. I didn't know it was him until like I kind of started seeing like his face. I was like, wait a minute, I think that's the same guy. Like the way that his beard aged him so well to where he could be able to play the adult version of Corey Wise as well. So that was an amazing, like, nice little use of character by Ava right there. I think because Ava had went to see him audition and she saw him like try out for this part, she was worried because she might have had to get another actor to play Corey Wise when he was an adult, but she saw that him with a beard, and she was like, well, hey, you can play both of these characters, because the other guys, they had to get, you know, adults to play they had to get other actors to play the adults, but Jahiel Jerome was able to do both of them, so that was great as well. Another thing I have to say is that also the accuracy of the real case and all of the events that happened were very accurate too. Down to the photographs, I could tell that Ava really studied this case. You know, she saw the photographs of Elizabeth and the kids doing their walks to the courtroom. She got the outfits right. She got the protests that were out there right. She got everything down to even using live actual footage and live actual calls from the night of the Central Park rape down to the newscast and the media that were around during that time. It was all great. It was like being in a time capsule, and you're just reliving through all of this. It's phenomenal work. Phenomenal work.
Absolutely. And I loved this thing from start to finish. So I'm really glad that we were able to sit down and do this. Please, if you haven't not checked out When They See Us, it is, I think, Colesse was saying, it is going to be one of the events and talked about, television events of this decade and maybe even of this millennia. It is a fantastic thing. If you had to give it a rating on our Rorschach rating scale, what would you give it, 1 to 5?
Oh, this is getting a 4 or 5. A 4 or 5 out of 5. Each and every time it's getting a 5. I mean, I don't like handing out 5 out of 5s. You know, I have a set criteria of what I look for in any piece of work. Like, it's really hard to get a 5 from me. So, you know, me giving this a 5 after the first watch, I was like, yeah, this is a masterpiece right here. This is honestly one of the best works of a limited series or miniseries I've seen ever in my lifetime. And I know that I will continue to go back to this. This will probably be like, there's certain films and shows that I like to watch once a year. It's like an annual pilgrimage for me, film pilgrimage. Like, it's so great that I at least need to see it once every year. And this is probably going to be one of those that fit into my category.
Absolutely. I think that this is a 5 out of 5, hands down. Like you said, like, there's just so much attention to detail that Ava brings as the director, and with the set design and just recreating of the culture and the backlash of and controversy that this case created, but also to really humanizing these characters, these real life people. And just terrific performances from the entire cast. It is completely engaging. It is a tough thing to sit through, but this is a series that I feel like everyone needs to really see. Everyone needs to experience at least once. So if you guys haven't checked out When They See Us, you guys just go sign up for Netflix just to watch this, because it is completely worth it. But that is actually going to do it for us. So if you guys have seen When They See Us, if you guys want to talk about some of the themes that we talked about, give your 2 cents on it, make sure that you guys tweet to us on Victims and Villains on Twitter or wherever you guys are listening to this. Make sure that you guys just leave some love in the comments section. And speaking of social media, where can people find you online, my friend?
You can find me on pretty much all of the social media platforms. On Facebook, my name is Colesse Davis. You'll find me on there. On Twitter, you can find me at the handle Black Nerd Magic. I'll pop up on there. And on Instagram, also my username on there is Black Nerd 91. You can find me on there as well.
All right. And you guys can follow us everywhere at Victims and Villains. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Twitch, and wherever you guys get your podcasts. If you guys like what we stand for and want to help us get mental health resources into schools, conventions, and other events, be sure to consider supporting us every month on Patreon, whereas for as little as $2 a month, you guys can not only dictate our content that we do on our main feed, but you guys can also get access to cool exclusive content as well. And if you guys want to, you guys can also consider picking up some swag on our Etsy shop. Colesse, thank you so much, man. Seriously, this series, this has been, I think, one of the best episodes that we've ever done. And it's a subject that when we sat down at the beginning of this year, we wanted to really create content that was more than just talking nerd and movies and comic books and video games, but create platforms for subjects like racial injustice and stuff like this that that When They See Us presents.
Nah, thank you so much, man, for having me on here. It's always a pleasure to have a great, you know, conversation about film, you know, comics, you know, anything pop culture related. It's always great, you know.
All right. Well, Until next time, remember to keep talking nerd, talking hope, speaking nothing else, and stay classy.